Coming up on This Week in Computer Hardware, NVIDIA 1660 overclocks even better than the 1660 Ti. AMD's Navi GPU launch date, Corsair's Crystal 680X case, a cheap 3D printer reviewed, and more all coming up next on Twitch.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twitch.
This is Twitch, This Week in Computer Hardware, episode 508, recorded on March 14th, 2019. 3.14 reasons to buy the GTX 1660. This episode of This Week in Computer Hardware is brought to you by On Deck. Are you a small business owner in need of capital today? Well, On Deck can help. With over $10 billion in loans and an A-plus rating from the Better Business Bureau, On Deck is a lender you can trust. Find out more at ondeck.com/Twitch. Welcome to Twitch, This Week in Computer Hardware, Twitch weekly show that aims to bring you the most delightful, most useful, most engaging, most affordable, most expensive, most terrifying, most, I don't know, we like hardware here. I'm Patrick Norton. I'm joined by Mr. Sebastian Peake from PCPer.com. And ladies and gentlemen, we have a surprise for you. Actually, Sebastian does. Mr. Peake?
What's the surprise?
I thought you had a review.
Oh, well, yeah. That's not a surprise to me. I've been living and breathing this thing for the last week. But yes, the
for
rumors were true.
Were not under NDA with you.
Right. Yeah, it's like deja vu all over again here at Twitch, because it wasn't too long ago that we had the GTX 1660 Ti launch. And everybody, you know, you have to know that when the Ti cards hit, there's got to be a counterpart without the Ti. And of course, that's what we got today.
One would hope.
Yeah. And they've got to hit their price points. It's all about product segmentation, as I'm learning. And it's not the most glamorous or exciting thing, but that's the reality of the graphics card world. But let's get right into it. The cards that I got in, very similar to what we had last time with the 1660 Ti launch here at the site, which is MSI sent us an overclocked version and EVGA sent us a stock version. So we got a look at both sides there. And what you get with the 1660, with the non-Ti, is very much the Ti all over again, or at least that's what I thought at first glance. Because if you're going over the specs, you're like, okay, it's still TU116, same core Turing architecture. It goes from 24 down to 22 SMs, which means 128 fewer CUDA cores. So you do have less GPU power at your disposal, but higher clocks. 1785 megahertz is the default boost clock on this. And almost every partner card is going to be overclocked to some extent. We'll talk about that later, but the big change is if you look at the memory, and it's still 6 gigabytes of memory, even on this cheaper card, but it's GDDR5 memory. So we're going all the way back to the GTX 1060, which this is effectively just straight up replacing. You know, Patrick, we'd talk about was the 1660 Ti kind of the replacement for the 1060? That was sort of my narrative with the last review. This just straight up is. Like, this is dropping right into that $219 price point where we've seen some of the 6 gigabyte 1060 cards selling for. Kind of that 220 right. to 230 range is where they ended up. And here it is. This is a card that NVIDIA said would be about 15% faster than a 1060 6 gigabyte, mm-hmm. which it is. It actually was a little bit greater than that. They seem to be understating the gains a little bit. But it was very much game dependent how much you were actually getting. I saw gains of up to 27% over a 1060 at 1080p. Or if you go to the most AMD-friendly benchmark, which is Ashes of the Singularity, that was only a 2.5% increase over the older Pascal card. So averaged out to somewhere between about 15 and 20% of a boost. And that's, you know, for $219, if you look at the review and if you look at reviews out there, I have in the mix an older 900 series card, the top end 980 Ti from that era. And this card at 1080p isn't too far off from a 980 Ti in most of the games, Ashes of the Singularity being the big outlier there. But it's pretty remarkable to me to see how a card that retails for $219. Mm-hmm. And I was testing at 1080p, I was just testing this base model from EVGA, which is at that 219 mark. Right. Is actually better than a 980 Ti. That's kind of crazy to me. So, I mean, this is how far we've come.
Well, so but yeah, it's also, yes, a 980 Ti was a $650 GPU at launch in the summer of 2015. That was a long time ago. That was,
well, yeah, it was
4 years ago. That's ancient in computing terms. That's generations, eons. That's you know, nations rise and fall in computer terms in 4 years. So part of me wants to say, like, gosh, couldn't it be just a little bit faster? Which makes me sound like the comments below the review. But, you know, I'm listening to you. You're sort of half stoked about this card. Yeah, I think you didn't get stoked about this card until you saw the performance compared to what used to be a $650 card. Because you kind of seem like it, you know, it's the card to buy if you don't have any money, or if, you know, if the most amount of money you can scrape together is $200. But should people try to scrape up to get a 1660 Ti, or is this kind of like the choice for 1080p gaming now?
If you look at the Ti, the performance level of the Ti, which is $60 more,
right?
And the cards, what I've been seeing as far as pricing goes, is they're ranging between $219 and $249 at the high end.
Okay.
So $249 is still $30 less than the Ti version. But $30, I mean, if you're that close, you'd think, well, why not just go the rest of the way? But a $249 card is going to be significantly overclocked from the factory. Most of these are going to have overclocking potential beyond that. I know we talked about overclocking last week with the RTX 2060 XC Ultra card, but it's become pretty obvious with these cards. This TU116 GPU, it's extremely OC friendly, and they've left a lot of performance on the table with this card. So if you are looking around, if you're shrewdly examining some of the overclocked results out there in reviews and looking at some of the factory overclocked cards and the clock speeds they offer out of the box, you can get really close to the Ti with a fairly easy overclock. And while GDDR5 memory does not overclock as well as GDDR6 from what we've seen so far, you can still, you know, boost it pretty significantly. I got 400 megahertz out of mine.
Whoa.
And out of the memory, and about 150 out of the core.
Okay.
And using the higher end card that we got in, this was the MSI card, which has its own custom PCB, beefier power delivery, I was sustaining those overclocks under load and consistently over 2 gigahertz under load, where that pushed me up to and even past, in some instances, even MSI's factory overclocked 1660 Ti from the last review. Mm-hmm. So if you're just buying it, and I was very surprised because I thought memory bandwidth would play a bigger role, and there's no way to overcome the disparity between GDDR5 and 6 with overclocking, because it just can't be overclocked that far. Like the memory at 12 gigabits per second is going to be impossible to reach when you're starting off with 8 gigabit per second GDDR5.
Right.
But 1440p overclocking testing, if you're looking at the video, it jumped like 3-4 places in the chart and was right up there with the 1070 again.
So like it's faster than my 1070. Delete expletive. Yeah. Well, so, okay, it seems like as we look at this, you know, 128 CUDA cores doesn't make that big a difference at 1080p. The huge, you know, it's like 90 gigabytes per second addition, almost not quite double, nowhere near double, like a third more, you know, it's more than a third more, almost like 50% more bandwidth in terms of memory bandwidth doesn't seem to make a difference. It's interesting for me to, because we've seen a lot of tests over the last years. Gamers Nexus a couple years ago did an amazing look at, like, okay, you know, one DIMM versus two DIMMs, you know, looking at memory speeds. And one of the takeaways for me was that it was like, boy, you know, following manufacturers' recommended locations and, you know, pairing of memory and motherboards makes for really fast memory benchmarks, which almost never trends into any measurable real world performance when you're looking at application level benchmarks. And it's interesting to see on a GPU because I'm with you, right? It's like, oh, it's got this huge amount of memory bandwidth. It's got another 128 CUDA cores. It feels like it should be much faster than it is. This is great. This is like AMD CPUs years ago where you're just like, yeah, I'm just going to turn this into a part that's worth twice as much.
Right. And that's without cool. even having to use like a pencil to trace out, you know, that the bridge that trace, like with the Athlon XPs or the Thunderbird. But
this may be triggering for some people in our audience. if you had any issues with parts back in the day involving pencils and various other problems with modifications, I digress. You were saying,
I love stuff that has this much headroom where. It, even with the stock card, I took the stock EVG card, right, which I have right here, which is once again one of those really compact but very thick, like three slot little cards, which is kind of growing on me. I had my reservations at first because I'm like, why would you want a card this small if it has to have three slots? But it doesn't take up much room inside your case and it runs very, very quiet. And I'm thinking, because this heatsink is so big, why not try pushing this one, even though it's not made for overclocking? And I ran the OC scanner, which is just an automated overclocking tool from NVIDIA, which is built into like Afterburner and EVGA's Precision X1. I ran it and, you know, left the room, come back 20 minutes later. It's like you get plus 143, which doesn't directly translate into a Turing overclock because they go in 15 megahertz increments, but still plus 135 or plus 150, somewhere in there. And I was conservative and went plus 135. And I was still getting close to 2 gigahertz, over 1900 megahertz, consistent, sustained boost clocks in game testing. So even a bone stock card with a 100% power limit locked still leaves a lot of performance on the table, where the manufacturers, if they really wanted to, could release these cards with a factory overclock of, you know, say 1900 megahertz boost and probably get pretty close to sustaining it even without giving you a bigger power limit. So I'm just kind of guessing here, but it seems like TU116 could have been clocked a lot more aggressively and perhaps may not have been to keep kind of the product segmentation, the spacing between the GPUs a little bit cleaner. Like, you know, it's a big jump to get up to that 2060 from a 1660 Ti. So you overclock the Ti and it's just as fast. So
I'm excited. I'm officially excited. And also they are not showing up yet on Amazon.com. Several are still in stock, including from EVGA and Asus on Newegg.com. Oh, I sense overclocking in my future.
Yeah, I just want to find, just like before, I want to find the card with the highest power limit and just go nuts. Because another thing, these still have an 8-pin power connector on them, even though it's just a 120-watt card, even though it draws less power even than the GTX 1060, it's got this 8-pin connector that's just begging you to make use of it, because that gives you 150 watts from your PSU plus board power. So you can, well, you know, you could potentially exceed or get close to, you could exceed 200 watts with this card. And I think I did, because I got close to like the 280, 290 range, full like system power from the wall with a Core i7 when I was overclocking this thing. So there's a lot of thermal headroom. There's, depending on the, you know, the partner card's design, there's definitely going to be, you know, I would say most of these cards are going to give you between 90 and 120 megahertz or more above stock boosts. So anyway,
just realized I can't fit that EVGA in my in the system I wanted to put it in.
Because it's three slots, right?
Yeah.
I don't know of any mini ITX cases that have three slots. There might be. It's
certainly none that I already own.
Yeah.
So Asus may be in my near future. I sense Editor's Choice Gold Award. How did this fare out?
I gave the Gold Award to the EVGA card because it's just a solid card, did everything right, nothing really wrong with it, and it's that stock 219 price and still had overclocking potential. But the MSI card, which I was actually beating a 1660 Ti with without any voltage modifications, I struggled with that. Actually, I gave that the gold. I was thinking Editor's Choice. I might have to go in and change that. But it's $30 more, but I felt the difference in price was more than offset by the fact that you have so much OC potential. But I think that's just kind of inherent to this product.
Chip.
Where we'll see other cards out there like EVGAs and ASUS and others, which are probably going to be hitting some of these aggressive clocks fairly easily. So it's just a really good... It becomes so much more interesting when we start talking about overclocking. If this was just a stock card and you couldn't overclock it, and this was like at its limit already, it's not interesting, honestly, because it's just a drop-in replacement for the 1060 as Pascal kind of dries up, and then this replaces it, and you get about 15% more performance. But it's been almost 2 years. That card came out in July of 2016. So you'd expect more performance.
It is most aged. Oh, man. You also actually, one of my favorite case series, Corsair's Crystal series, they just dropped a couple of new additions to that. And you got hands on, you put the system out with the 680X RGB ATX tempered glass case. If you are looking for a machine to show off the glorious innards of your computer, the Crystal series, I think, is, if it's not high on your list, it should be, unless you don't like LEDs, in which case you will find this setup maddening. Or you'll just start clipping wires. Is it safe to say, oh, look, another attractive, thoughtfully laid out, you know, hot stuff on the top, stuff you need to keep cool on the bottom, Corsair design that's not particularly loud, but not as quiet as some of their dedicated quiet cases?
Well, yeah, with a lot of cases, and I've been doing case reviews for 5 years now, and I've seen a lot of different designs. And I will also say that in that 5 years, I have not reviewed very many cases that are this expensive. So we've it's $250. So it's as much as a GPU. I mean, it's as much as the MSI card that we were just talking about. And so for a case, that's not quite into like Case Labs territory, and they're no longer with us. So maybe Corsair is like carving out a niche in that like very high end of the market left by Case Labs. But this is one of those big, like you mentioned the Air 540 is basically what this reminds me of. It's a big dual chamber case. And partly because of that premium price tag, they've kind of gone all out with this thing. And all the Crystal series cases have tempered glass galore. This has three panels, front, top, and side. The door.
So pause the video right where it is, because we should point out when you're saying dual enclosure, Sebastian, you can see sort of there's the glass side of the top and there's a big white painted metal section of the top. Essentially, the power supply and all of your back, you know, all of the wiring that is too ugly to be seen gets routed through the back of that to eliminate the heat from the power supply from the rest of the system.
Yeah. And in a lot of cases, you have maybe an inch, sometimes a little bit more, behind the motherboard tray to cram all your cable mess. And this is dual chamber cases give you what is essentially a full ATX case on one side. And then behind that, you have like a slim ATX case, which is still pretty, I mean, it's big enough to put power supply, hard drives, and then give you like enough room to fit any amount of cables and still a lot of space left over for things like reservoirs if you're doing a custom water cooling loop, that sort of thing. So just a tremendous amount of room in this case. But of course, that also means it takes up a lot of space. It has a big footprint.
Right.
It kind of looks like a mini fridge. And I didn't think about that when I asked for the white version. I thought the white version just kind of looked cool. But we were talking about it last night and it's like, this looks like a wine cooler. Like, well, I mean... Sort of. I mean, an RGB one.
Well, it reminds me. So they used to call them like the dog boxes or the dog houses, which is a particular class of server that you don't really see anymore. But it was very, very low, very, very wide and very, very long, and it always had wheels. So you could kind of like stuff it under a you know, the pictures you usually see from people using them in the field was like there was a car, there was a folding table in the back of a room with a lot of Ethernet cables, and then they would have a, two or three of these things stuffed under a card table. It does have, I mean, it was it, you know, massive sitting on your desk? Was it kind of like, you know, this needs to be the focus of your desk? Would you put it on the floor? It seems like if you're going to go to the trouble of putting all those glass cases or all the glass on this, you're going to want to display it. It sounds like you're going to need a really big desk.
Yeah. I mean, it's, I have it at arm's reach almost, but this thing is, it's quite heavy. It's only about a foot and a half tall, maybe a little bit more than that, but it's just kind of like a 2-ish foot cube. You have to have, so you have to have that amount of space for it. But I would not put this under a desk. I mean, I don't know why you'd pay a premium for a case that has all this tempered glass and these really fancy RGB fans on the front, and then, you know, put it out of view. So I don't know. But the RGB aspect of this, it's not like they went overboard. It's still pretty subtle because it's just the front fans. And I don't know if you've seen other Corsair cases that have these new fans. I think it was last year I tested the Crystal 280X, which is kind of the mini micro ATX version of this. So a much smaller scale dual chamber case. But these fans have 16 individually addressable lights in each of them. So you've got a total of 40-something lights between just the three fans, which you can control with their software. And actually, one of the things about this case was there's a built-in RGB controller that can sync up with all the other Corsair RGB-lighted things you may own. And so you could have your keyboard and mouse and case fans and everything all pulsing to the same custom pattern or glow or whatever color you want. So that was kind of interesting. But essentially, it's just a really well-made, big, nice case. There are convenience and intelligent design features, like it has a hinged glass door. It's magnetically, like it closes magnetically, so it's easy to open, access everything. The fans are on brackets, the front fans and the top fans or radiator are on these easy to remove brackets that has come off with two of these captured thumb screws, and you pull the whole bracket off, and then on the other side of the bracket, it's a magnetically attached filter. So you have to worry about like undoing snaps or like removing the front to get to things. You just do it all from right inside the case, pop the door open, you know, pull out a couple thumb screws, swap out a screen, or, you know, like vacuum off or rinse your screen, put it back. So maintaining, like living with this case over a long period of time would be very easy. So it does kind of help mitigate the cost, because it's like, well, this might be the last case I buy for the next 5 or 10 years. But
the enthusiast cry, this will be the last speakers I ever own. This will be the last headphones ever owned.
Yeah, I'm not defending the price. It's, I could see this being like $199, but $249, it just starts to feel like, I don't know. It's...
Well, if you're
spending
$2,000 on a GPU and $1,000 on a CPU and a couple hundred on memory, at that point, it may be sort of, you know, not exactly a rounding error, but less traumatic than, say, if you're in the $1,000 or under build world.
Yeah.
I am curious. We got a link to a WCCF Tech article that suggests that AMD's 7-nanometer Navi GPU is going to launch about a month after Ryzen 3000, 7/7/19 being, assumedly, probably 7 a.m. on the 7th day of the 7th month will be the 7-nanometer launch of the 7-nanometer Ryzen 3000 7-nanometer. Did you hear that, Intel 7-nanometer CPU?
It had better launch at like 7:07 a.m. too.
Oh, I like that even better, 7:07, or perhaps 7:77, as my child tried to tell me about, who's learning how to read the clock. But Gamescom 2019 being the potential loss, and it's interesting because Usman Pirzada points out that Navi was originally supposed to launch in 2018, But does this feel solid? Does this particular rumor feel like a trustworthy rumor? I love saying trustworthy. Does this feel like a trustworthy rumor to you, sir?
Do you have a lot of security in this rumor? Actually, when they start throwing around like board partners, that's when I start to think maybe there's some credence to this, because in this industry, obviously the partners are going to know about things before the media does. And, you know, maybe somebody let something slip in an email or something, and now they're not revealing sources, of course, but this report seemed pretty confident. We will see. One of the things I remarked in the post I wrote about this is that very often what will happen is there's a pretty consistent like lead up to a graphics launch where we'll start to hear these reports, which may or may not come from board partners. Then we start to see like renders of box art, and then we start to see like GPU renders and promotional photos and things like that. And that's about a month out from a launch pretty frequently. Right. So we're not going to have any verification of this unless AMG just comes out and says it until probably July, if indeed they are launching in August. Although I don't think it's out of the realm of possibility for them to pre-announce. AMD does like to pre-announce GPUs. NVIDIA does not. Obviously, right. At CES, we saw Radeon 7. It didn't come out for another month. So they could go on stage at E3 and announce this stuff, too.
So. Oh, my goodness. This one, the Inquirer actually was running this one up. Alleged AMD Navi benchmarks suggest GPUs are being properly tested. GFX Bench has a listing as AMD 66AF:F1, noting that it's Windows
Multics great name.
Compatible. It's a fantastic name.
The USB IF named that one.
The intriguing part, of course, as Roland Moore Collier writes, that it was alongside a comparison with AMD's Radeon RX Vega 56 GPU. And show that it was on par with the Vega 56, which I would have thought it would have been higher. But, you know, are we talking about a less expensive GPU being the first thing to come out in the Navi lineup? Does this smell like a 1060, 2060, 16, I should say 1660 Ti / 2060 competitor, something in that price range? Or is it just entirely too vague to even begin to start guessing at this aspect of it?
I personally think it's a little vague, but if we're talking about that performance level, then, you know, a Vegas 56 is pretty powerful. I had kind of forgotten about that until I was retesting graphics cards.
Because they were impossible to buy for so long.
Yeah. It was just unobtainium during the mining fiasco. So,
yeah.
Like, this is really fast. This is faster than, I think it depends on the game, but it's faster than a 2060, or it certainly can be. It's definitely faster than a GTX 1660 Ti. That's probably the one I'm thinking of. But somewhere in between there, I mean, if this comes out as the replacement to the RX 580, that would be fantastic, because, you know, I'd love to see Vega 56 levels of performance or close to down in the $200, $220 price range. That would really change things. That would force NVIDIA and their partners to drop prices, which I'm sure we would see in the form of like mail-in rebates and stuff. But
right.
It's pretty vague, and it's also unclear what the architecture is. So this could be Navi, and it might not be. So I like how they call it mysterious. Like when you're down to like a string, like 66AF:F1. Right. It's very early days if this is a Navi or Navi product. But I'm not...
recently taped from the factory.
Yeah. I'm not under any NDAs or anything. I have heard nothing official. That's why, you know, we often find out things, you know, weeks in advance, sometimes longer. Right. But nothing. So I would not be surprised if this is still probably coming later in the year. And August seems about as early as we might expect.
I also think at this point AMD is being really cautious about announcing anything that they can't ship on time, or there might be any tiny delay in shipping. It feels that way. I was kind of fascinated with the update from Microsoft. Peter Bright did write up at Ars Technica. Windows 7, if you're paying attention, is Biscuit or four away, months away from no longer receiving security updates, which should signal the impending death of the operating system. Given the number of zombie XP systems that are still floating around the internet being used to do nefarious things, I think my statement of them being, migrated to Windows 10 is probably more about hope than what was actually going to happen. But I thought this was really odd. It was a patch for World of Warcraft, Battle for Azeroth, version 8.1.5, one of the pretty recent patch. And they added in chunks of the user mode for Direct 3D 12 and to Windows 7. So odd. Especially, as Mr. Bright points out, that Microsoft, quote, insists that Windows 10 remains the best place to run D3D12 applications.
Of course,
because that's the only place they're really working on the Direct3D12 stack. Why on earth would they drop something, an update like this? I mean, would you think, is this like World of Warcraft paid them? It just seems very curious.
But why? Why would they? Why? I don't understand why they would need to.
Yeah.
And it's also, I wonder, is this something that we're going to have to wait for a graphics update? And how will they even phrase this? Like, the latest, NVIDIA driver now includes support for Direct 12-ish features in Windows 7. Yeah. Unsupported operating system.
One of the things that he quotes in the article is that Blizzard... Well, I'll read it. Quote, Blizzard found that there was a, quote, substantial frame rate improvement from updating World of Warcraft to use D3D12, thanks to D3D12's improved support for distributing the work of building graphical scenes across multiple threads. Multi-threading is good. I think everybody agrees on that one. I just wonder who paid for this. Was this why would they add something this significant to Windows 7 this late? I'm glad you found this one, because it's kind of fascinating and kind of strange.
The first thing that this my cynical mind thinks is, of course they always could have enabled DirectX 12 on Windows 7 if they really wanted to, just as they could have enabled that on Windows 8 or 8.1. It's a selling point. There's a reason that DirectX 10 was a Vista exclusive. It was to get gamers to upgrade to a new operating system, which also helped the industry because, you would go out and buy pre-built PCs that came with Windows Vista on them. Of course, Windows Vista was a terrible nightmare. And when Windows 7 came out, that was like, it was such a breath of fresh air. It was such a better performing system. Like, the same hardware was so much faster than Windows 7. There are people who I've made the argument probably here and other places before. When people saw DVD coming from VHS, they were just like, this is it. This is amazing. It was so much better than VHS that they just didn't care about the things that came afterwards. They don't care about necessarily like high definition TVs. Well, that's kind of the standard now, obviously. And then they didn't really care about Blu-ray. There are lots of people who still watch DVDs in their Blu-ray player, which is alarming to me, but it's another subject.
Let it go.
Yeah, don't get me started. I can't let it go. But
I'm with you. I should also point out that if you are an enterprise or you have a volume license on Windows 7, you can pay for up to 3 years of fixes.
Oh, yeah.
And it's as much as I may make it sound like Windows 7 security updates are dropping tomorrow, it's actually through January 14th, 2020. So you have ways to go yet. I think I was being a little too panicky about the impending loss of security updates. So,
hey, maybe Blizzard will pay for those too, just for their Windows 7 WoW user base.
It's a tempting thought.
I wonder if that's a legitimate issue. Maybe it's because of maybe they have enough data that shows that were they to, I don't know, is there that much of a backlash against Windows 10 at this point that they would be afraid of losing valuable subscribers to their monthly game if people just refuse to upgrade to Windows 10?
I don't know. A couple weeks ago, I think if we put the product manager for Windows 10 in front of you, you would have hit him with a baseball bat. I would be curious to see like what, I don't think anybody there is going to release the stats on the average age of the average system that a really dedicated World of Warcraft player is running on. But, it's a possibility or, we live in a world where people are for fun, recreating systems from 20 years ago to play video games from 20 years ago. And in many cases, trying to find new old stock unopened parts to do it with. So,
spying on me? What is happening here?
Your wife.
I don't know anything about seeking out and purchasing a late 1990s aluminum AT form factor case recently, or a matching 486 motherboard and a new inbox Pentium DX4, or not Pentium, the 486, the DX4. Yeah, none of that stuff. Or any of the, weird random one-off video cards and stacks of old spinning hard drives that I have.
I'll send you my compact portable too. I now know there's a good home for it in Michigan.
Ooh, nice. Yeah.
This episode of This Week in Computer Hardware brought to you by OnDeck. OnDeck is 100% committed to small business owners with fast, easy, tailored financing. Your time is valuable. You're running a business, right? How about getting funding in as fast as 24 hours, term loans up to $500,000, lines of credit up to $100,000, none of which require business collateral. And if you are the business, that's a good thing to hear. The application process is simple. You can apply online or by phone, get approved in minutes, and it won't impact your personal credit. That's nice. OnDeck delivers some of the best customer service with their U.S.-based loan specialists. They have an A-plus rating with the Better Business Bureau. You might be thinking, who is OnDeck? Well, they've lent over $10 billion to over 80,000 small business owners. OnDeck is a secure financing service that business owners anywhere can truly rely on. If you're a small business owner and need access to capital, go to ondeck.com/twitch right now. And as a listener of This Week in Computer Hardware, you'll receive a free consultation with one of their U.S.-based loan specialists. Apply online or by phone and get approved in minutes. Go to ondeck.com/twitch. That's ondeck.com/TWICH for your free consultation now. And we want to thank OnDeck for their support of This Week in Computer Hardware. So, what did Microsoft do last week that broke everything?
they issued a one of their fixes for something that, of course, didn't really fix anything. It created more problems. What is the actual number here? It was KB4482887. A quality improvement update. And this was coming on the heels of like the Retpaline Windows 10 slowdown mitigation stuff. And it was affecting games. It was affecting input and performance of games. So Destiny 2 and others, that was one of the major titles that was mentioned. So let's just say here, in light of the above and for PC gamers, quote, it addresses an issue that may degrade graphics and mouse performance when desktop gaming when playing certain games such as Destiny 2 after installing the update. So basically, whatever mitigations they had come up with was causing some sort of problems either between the input and the game or glitches within the game itself that was causing detrimental, performance-related problems. There's a huge list. If you actually go to Microsoft's article about this fix, but I'm just looking at the report from Hexis that Mark Tyson wrote up. But it's just interesting, you know, the coming on the heels of this, of course, is Microsoft saying that they now have the ability to remove bad updates remotely from Windows 10. So I'm sure that's something that would have immediately affected this. Like you download, you install this, and then it just disappears and the problems go away. So they can kind of flush it out. But, you know, once again, an example of how Microsoft is kind of using their actual user base for quality control, perhaps.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I don't know.
It's like, here's a patch. Oh, it didn't work? All right. Well, uninstall it then. And we'll try it again.
At this point, I'm still kind of reeling from, you know, at this point, I will say I've, for the most part, had really, really good luck with most of the updates that have hit. I've had really terrible luck with finding my machine having restarted itself to install an update while I had something else going on.
you walk away, you come back.
But that's the Windows 10 lifestyle. NVIDIA bought Mellanox, which I thought was really curious. You know, they spent a lot of money doing it, close to $7 billion. There's an, if you're not familiar with the name, it's an Israeli chip maker. And Intel tried to buy them not too long ago for a healthy $6 billion. And this is actually something that NVIDIA is targeting to advance their server business. Something I didn't realize until I read this article up on Engadget was that NVIDIA's servers business at this point is about a third of their sales. You know, so that's a fair chunk of money. And the reason that Intel is also interested in them is they do high-end Ethernet and InfiniBand networks, or the chips that create the high-speed networks that connect between servers, which you're primarily finding in data centers and cloud systems. Do you think this is anything from this is going to show up on the consumer side, on the GPU side of things, or is this purely an enterprise purchase?
It seems to be. And they have their own, obviously on desktop, they're primarily concerned with GPUs at this point, but you know, they did their mobile play. I can honestly not think of any phones that are using Tegra anymore. They may have completely distanced themselves from that. They're, you know, the desktop or the set top presence. And of course they're in the gaming world now because they had that big win with Nintendo with the Switch. But as far as this goes, and even though they are a company that does you know, some of those more like embedded type solutions with high performance chips, like you said, this is probably on that like enterprise side that we don't really cover. It is interesting. This is something that makes suddenly their stock a lot more attractive, which may or may not have had something to do with it, but it's a lot of money to spend. And I didn't know anything about this company. I'm looking at $6.9 billion and then something about a bidding war with Intel to buy it. And it's like, well, obviously this company has something to offer because, you know, two pretty heavy hitters. And I would have assumed of the two, Intel would be the one to triumph. But maybe they just drew the line at some number. But $6.9 billion. You know, we see companies like Apple buy a chip company like PA Semiconductor, I think it was called. And it's like there's a very specific reason for it. Just like when they shut down, I think it was called MagicWorks, the company that had developed the multi-point capacitive touch that eventually went into the first iPhone. But I don't think they're buying this for technology in the same way. They're not, you know, they're buying it for, this is a company that has established products that are in use in the industry. And I wonder just how many years it will take for them to even come close to breaking even on this. But hey, enterprise is big business. I don't pretend to know very much about it. It's just, obviously, they need to do something because their stock had been tumbling and significantly. So this does help. They're certainly not. It's enthusiasts like me are not going to save their business or maybe even be like a long-term viable solution to their business. So they're, you know, they're doing that boring corporate thing of, you know, diversifying and going into the enterprise space in a big way. So
I got to say, are you excited about Halo showing up on the PC?
Again? I know the original Halo came out on PC, and I think Halo 2 had a PC version. But yeah, it's been Xbox only for years and years. I was never a Halo player. I don't know about you. It somehow missed me completely, but I wasn't a big FPS player either. It's more of like a strategy game nerd on the PC for a long time. But
I always enjoyed it, and then I didn't have access to an Xbox anymore, and it became kind of moot.
Well, yeah, that's the thing. So now anybody, I believe this is on, it's going to be on Steam.
Yeah.
Wow, one of the few things that's on Steam anymore, it seems. Not the Epic Game Store, that's another conversation. But it brings it to a new audience, and it allows people who would have liked to enjoy it again, but maybe aren't on an Xbox platform, to get into it. I'm curious as to how it will fare as far as like the multiplayer aspect, because everybody, I would not be shocked at all if there was a Halo Battle Royale mod coming down the road now that this is on the PC again, because that's what everybody wants, apparently. Battlefield 5, Battle Royale is coming. Fortnite has changed everything.
Fortnite. Yeah, I was going to say Fortnite. This is...
You know, this is the mature option, because Fortnite, and there's absolutely nothing wrong with this. This is great, but Fortnite is largely a game enjoyed by kids, like young people, younger than me. Mm-hmm. And we were looking at demographics on Fortnite actually last night, and numbers that literally only report 18 and up, still that 18 to 24 is like 2/3 of the base, but what is that slice? Because I imagine if you take like 17 and under playing Fortnite, that's got to be at least like 2/3 or 3/4 of the entire base. So the younger set is definitely into Fortnite, and then Halo is, you know, kind of a vintage classic thing. It's not Duke Nukem 3D level vintage, but this was, you know, an early, extremely popular multiplayer shooter experience. So
it's nostalgia.
Yes, exactly. That's what they're selling you on, the nostalgia of something that's 10 years old plus. So,
well, as of a year ago in May, the distribution was 62.7% 18 to 24, 22.5% 25 to 34, 12.7% 35 to 44, and 2% 45 to 54 in Fortnite players. So 72.4% male, 27.6% female. No numbers, of course.
I have not installed or played Fortnite yet. I wonder if are people lying and saying they're 18 to install it, or is it not a game that requires you to be 18? Because it'd be interesting to see what that like under 18 user base is, because it's got to be just massive.
Well, let me do some quick math to see whether or not this totals up to 100%. It's been so long since I installed it, I can't actually remember if it asks the age for the account. I'm sure it does. Well, that's 99.9%. So they only looked at 18 and above in this one.
Is Fortnite the next Pokemon Go? Will they lose, you know, 80% of their daily users by next year? Or will it continue? Will it change everything?
I had some fun this week. Shannon got hands-on with the new Galaxy S10, which has not one, not two, but three cameras on the back, one of which works better than the other two, and hopefully all of which will be improved in firmware. But if you want to find out what's going on with that, I'm going to politely ask you to head to Tech Thing. I finally got a review done of Monoprice's Mini Delta 3D printer, and I got this in. I saw it printing at an event, and I was like, wow, that's a pretty solid print for a $160 printer. In part because the first 3D printer I had access to, I built, and it was one of those machines where you spent it was like a 1-to-1 ratio between tightening zip ties and tweaking things to print time, and the prints were atrocious. But it was a sub-$300 printer, which is a minor miracle at that point. Ended up with a nicer printer bot later on. It was pretty fantastic. I played around with that I also built from a kit. Played around with another half dozen printers. And this was really amazing for me because it was $160. It is really solidly built. There's a steel subframe. That upright frame you're looking at is aluminum. It felt fairly burly. Some people have, I did not crack open the guts, but underneath that, if you're looking at the video right now, you can kind of see the tower. It's a Delta design, which has three sets of legs, so it looks like a hyperactive spider when it's printing. Very simple, easy to use control panel, big colorful LCD with three buttons. Some people have suggested that the wiring inside of the case is atrocious and can be improved. And this is certainly, I decided, it was amazing, right? Because it comes with a test print of a Neko Kitty from the factory. And for the better part of like months, that was the only thing I could successfully get to print out of it. There were issues, I never actually got the Cura installation or the Cura software that was came from the factory. The profile for the Cura software that came from the factory was kind of atrocious. Cura is actually a pretty sweet package. But it was amazing because between Reddit and then the MP Mini Delta website, which is an enthusiast website that was put together, I don't know if it was by consumers or by Monoprice, but Monoprice doesn't have, this is one of those products where it's like the K70 laser cutters, where there's a piece of hardware and then a whole group of people accrete around it. And over time it becomes somewhat more functional and useful because everybody knows the tricks and the hacks and the tips. But there's a guy named Brian Kurtz put together profiles for this printer. And in the video, you can kind of see like balls of, it's amazing. The difference between a good profile and a bad profile is this being a 3D print. Of course, the camera won't focus on it because it's such a, just think of spider vomit versus something that actually looks like the 3D printed top I was trying to make. And it was literally like the difference between six unsuccessful prints in a row and a perfect print on the first try was having the correct profile for the 3D printer. And I say this in part because 3D printing is, a lot of people still think it's like, I'm going to buy this thing and we download stuff from Thingiverse and we print them out. It's going to be awesome. But it was not awesome. It was really, really frustrating. I also had a Harbor Freight moment with the printer because I did not look underneath the 3D printer when I pulled it out of the box and put it on my recycled with my own Pretty Little Princess Hands oak tabletop in the kitchen, and immediately gouged a chunk out of the table in the kitchen because one of the feet was missing. That said, I've done a ton of printing on it, and outside of some issues with feeding the filament into it, it's actually been phenomenally solid and well functional. There's our hacks for it to make it sound quieter. Third parties have created boards so you can modify it with. There are borosilicate glass print plates that a lot of people recommend upgrading the factory print plate to. But if you don't need a huge build size, because it's essentially, I want to say, 110 millimeter circle that it prints to. It's I want to say 120 millimeters high. So it kind of prints a cylinder rather than a square. If you want to play around with something that's easy to use and does a pretty good, like it's 50 micron layers of half millimeter layers. If you get those profiles and run the latest version of Cura, it works really, really well. They also have another printer I might check out that does not print as thin a layer. It's running millimeter layers, but the MP Select Mini 3D Printer V2, which has a significantly larger build volume, or excuse me, 0.1 millimeter layers, one millimeter layer. 1 millimeter layers would be huge. But there were a couple other issues with the Mini Delta. It's a very primitive USB or a very primitive Wi-Fi chip. So if your 5 gigahertz and 2.5 gigahertz networks have the same name, it will get confused and not be able to pick and will not log into your Wi-Fi. So you'll need to change, and between that and the USB, not really wanting to connect to several computers to try to connect it to you, I just output my files to a micro SD card and use the micro SD card to print. You know, buffer underruns can be a problem on USB with 3D printers, so I tend to avoid that anyway. And, you know, I didn't want to rebuild. I didn't want to have to reset a bunch of machines in my house after I changed part of my mesh network to change the SSID for the 2.4 gigahertz network. But if you're looking for one, it's pretty good. It's essentially, you know, what Monoprice is doing is rebranding, in this case and a couple of the other models, Malian Sys 3D printers out of China that are being rebranded and sold over here. I liked it. Initially, it was one of the most frustrating products I've ever dealt with. And once I finally cobbled onto the tools to make it print properly, it was amazing. And I've seen, you know, different applications and profiles make a difference on a printer before, but none as dramatic as this one did. So if you're thinking about 3D printers and you don't want to spend a ton of money, this might be one to look at. And they have so many printers there. So many 3D printers. And some pretty actually amazing planar magnetic headphones for the money. The 565C, which is a closed over-ear planar magnetic that's right now selling for $200, down from the original price of $230. It is a fantastic piece of gear for the money. Not that you need any more headphones in your life, sir.
I have very few headphones in relation to speakers. So there needs to be you need balance in your life. And
a 1-to-1 ratio? Know,
yeah. The one thing I just have kept myself from ever delving into is the separates world. I don't have any separate preamps and power amplifiers. I just have integrated amplifiers, but headphones, you know, I'll have like 3 or 4 or 5 pairs of headphones at a time. And then I have a hard time buying more.
Not like your speaker problem. You only have 5 sets of headphones.
No. There were some dark times in the speaker era in this house where it was like I owned a hi-fi shop. Like it was like, oh, I've got like 7 pairs of bookshelf speakers. I've got like 3 tower speakers here. And I could have made up a little showroom. But I'm pretty much just down to my Maggies for my tower speakers. I have a pair of Cantons, which actually have some of the best treble I've ever heard. And it's just like, you know, is it worth keeping a pair of speakers just because I like the tweeters?
Absolutely.
And then various, right. It's like, if I want to hear this song, I want to hear this drum solo with those tweeters. But, you know, really all they do is collect dust, just like my MagnaPans do. And I end up using bookshelf speakers or headphones all the time. That's another matter. Thanks for bringing up headphones, by the way. I need to go to Monoprice now. Like $200 for planar headphones. That's like $100 less than the cheap, like even those inexpensive ones from like HyperX that were based on the Odyssey or Odyssey. Is it Odyssey or Odyssey? Does anybody know?
Odyssey.
Odyssey. Odyssey. Okay.
I've interviewed Sankar. I said Odyssey. He did not correct me, so I'm going to roll with that and assume it's correct.
But is it Odyssey or Odyssey?
I just say Odyssey.
Okay.
If they change it, I'll let you know. One last thought before we go. It is not St. Patrick's Day today. It is Pi Day. As Kevin, our beloved producer, and Sebastian pointed out to me, ignorant fool that I am. So I immediately, to compensate for my lack of knowledge, found out that today Google calculated a new record-breaking number of digits. 30, I just look at that number and just cringe. 31.4 trillion digits of Archimedes constant on Google Cloud. Of course, this was a testament to the glories of Google Cloud's infrastructure, which I think they're it's awesome. It's if you're a math nerd, this is exciting. If you're not a math nerd, it's still kind of exciting. But they're running on Google Cloud, and then YCruncher, quote, a Pi Beta benchmark program developed by Alexander J. Yi using a Google Compute Engine virtual machine cluster, and it's pretty crazy.
you know, you can gain access to this. And they have this Pi dot delivery service.
Right.
But I love the group name. It's a Google group. Pi-31415926535897 is the name of the group. this is for the very the math enthusiasts in your life. It's just $40 a day to keep the clone disk for your projects.
If you scroll up a little bit, there's a box with the additional detail for everybody watching on the video right there. 111.8 days of total computation time. Total start to end time was 121.1 days. 96 virtual CPUs with 1.4 terabytes of RAM. And then it just gets really crazy.
then it gets crazy.
Yeah, 24 nodes of M1 standard, 16 virtual CPUs, 60 gigabytes of memory, 10 terabytes of SSD, persistent disk attached to each node, 240 terabytes in total, 170 terabytes used maximum. Total disk I/O, 9.02 petabytes read, 7.95 petabytes written. That's petabytes, kids. Petabytes are very, very big numbers. Yeah, it's 1,024 terabytes or a million gigabytes. So, yay, Google. Shout out to computers advancing our mathematical knowledge. I just am utterly fascinated and slightly terrified by the idea of running an application for 121 days. Wow. That's a long time.
Yeah, think about it. People were running applications for far longer than that, trying to score a Bitcoin a while back. So at least this advances our knowledge.
24/7.
Well, yeah. 121 days. I've been running this thing for 2 years.
I made $8.
Yeah, once you pay the power bill.
Oh, my goodness. Yeah, the power bills can be a little terrifying. I was going for a transition there and completely lost it. Speaking of terrifying, what's coming up at PC Purr just didn't seem appropriate. But speaking of terrifying, what's coming up at PC Purr?
My mind is a blank. there's a lot of stuff. I mean, I got a couple laptops in. I know that you recently looked at a Lenovo laptop over at Tech Thing. So we have a couple of those to look at. Lots more components, motherboards. Some new coolers we're looking at. We have more cases. In fact, similar to the Corsair case we looked at today, that 680X, Be Quiet, which is the German company that specializes in the ultra quiet cases, and they're very reserved. And they're a German company that it kind of has that sort of Mercedes-Benz aesthetic. It's very understated, a lot of black. In fact, almost every one of their products is black.
Teutonic comes to mind.
Yeah, well, out of nowhere at CES, they had a white case with RGB lighting, which is the very first time they've ever done it. But it's interesting because it's not just another RGB case. It's very subtle, and it's not what you might expect. That's my teaser for that. I'll probably get that up at some point in the next week. But, you know, it's the never-ending string of computer components at the site. Hopefully we're done with GPU launches for at least a couple weeks. I mean, I need a break.
With that, ladies and gentlemen, you've been listening to Twitch This Week in Computer Hardware, Twitch Weekly Show for, guess what? Hardware, all the hardware, mobile, desktop, consoles, games. We love it. To learn more about the show and to find older episodes and how to subscribe, please go to twit.tv/TWICH. For more Mr. Sebastian Peake, you can head on over to PCPurr.com. And if you aren't completely tired of me, I'm Patrick Norton. You can find me over at Tech Thing or AV Excel, which is a home theater and audio podcast. I do with Mr. Robert Herron, who knows all about televisions. And we want to thank you so much for joining us this episode of Twitch. I'm Patrick Norton.
And I'm Sebastian Peake.
We'll catch you next week on Twitch.